Ready to rise above loud, angry headlines? Longing for an alternative to the world's fighting and fear-mongering? Christianity Today magazine offers a trustworthy, faithful perspective on stories that matter to you, from the church next door to movements and ministries all around the world. Subscribe to CT for full access to in-depth reporting, insightful commentary, and redemptive storytelling, both online and in print. A subscription to CT also includes seasonal devotionals, special issues, and exclusive content. Visit orderct.com today or click the link in the show notes to get started and join a growing community of thoughtful, evangelical Christians who value different news that makes a difference. That's orderct.com to subscribe today.
This episode is brought to you in part by Litvin School of Mission, Ministry, and Leadership at Wheaton College. Our graduate programs in evangelism, ministry, and leadership enrich your mind, spirit, vocation, and character to refine what's already within you. Learn more at wheaton.edu/CT.
Hello, this is Russell Moore, and you're listening to Signposts. Today, I want to talk about the worst parenting mistake I think I've ever made. And when I say that, the first thing I want to say is there will be a lot of you out there who are not parents, a lot of you who aren't married, a lot of you who are maybe even in college or high school, and you think, well, this doesn't apply to me. This only applies to people who are in the thick of it in parenting. And I would say, no, this actually does apply to you, and I'll tell you why later on. But I've been thinking about this a lot lately because I've been working on a project having to do with family and talking to a lot of people who have had difficult times in their own family life, whether it's people who are having a difficult time working through singleness, or people who are having difficult marriages, or people who are having difficulty with parenting. And I was thinking about, where have I made my biggest mistakes and where are my biggest regrets? And there are a lot of them, so it's hard to narrow down on just one. But there's one mistake that I made that I think explains almost every other mistake that I've made, and not just in parenting, but in the rest of the way that I carry out my life. And maybe that's the case for you too. When Maria and I were working through the adoption process, we were adopting our first two boys. One of the things that goes along with that is a home study from a social worker, and we were nervous about the social worker coming in because it's kind of as though someone's coming in and evaluating you and giving you a grade on your house and whether or not your house is acceptable for a child. So there was a great deal of nervousness that came with it. Turned out, it actually was a very pleasant experience. But at the end of the time with the social worker, she started giving to us sort of her advice and her direction about how to rear children. And she said, don't ever say no to the child, and don't ever say anything that is negatively worded to the child at all. And I just said, ever? She said, never. Don't ever say anything negative. And so I just said, well, what if your child were, say, running out too close to traffic? Are you not going to say, don't do that, stop, no, don't go into traffic? And she said, well, rather than saying no or don't, find a way to distract the child, maybe with, say, a big red ball. And she laughed. And Maria and I, we didn't have children at the time, but we knew enough about just basic human nature to know that what she was telling us was absurd. And I said to Maria, I don't ever want to be caught alone in an alley with one of her grown children one day. And my wife said, well, certainly not without a big red ball. And we kind of thought about that for a long time, the mentality and the idea that parenting is not about at all providing any sense of structure. So the idea of permissive parenting, of simply finding those points of connection with the child, that seemed absurd to us, and I think rightly so. I think that that mentality is absurd. But as the years went by, I think about a lot an anecdote that I used to tell often when I was in front of evangelical Christian audiences that would agree with me on most things. Whenever I was talking about parenting and discipline, I would recount an incident that happened when our boys, our oldest boys, were 3 or 4 years old, and we were going through that time of fits and temper tantrums that would happen at that age. And Maria and I had one of the morning talk shows on as we were getting ready for church. And the talk show host said, after the commercial break, we'll be back to talk to a parenting expert about fits and tantrums. Maria and I said, This is what we need to see. We need to find out how to deal with fits and tantrums from the parenting expert. And the parenting expert then came on after the break and said, here's what you need to do when your child starts pitching a fit in public. That was especially, I think Maria and I both stopped and were paying attention because one of our sons particularly would just go into complete meltdown often in public places and grocery stores and so forth. And so we wanted to pay attention to what this guy said. And he said, what you do is simply kneel down and look your child that's throwing the fit into the eye. And you repeat back in a calm, gentle voice whatever it is that the child is screaming. So if the child is screaming because he wants a cookie, then what you do is you just repeat, you want a cookie, you want a cookie, you want a cookie, you want a cookie. And the parenting expert said, eventually, the child's going to realize that you get what he's saying, you understand what he or she is saying, and then the temper tantrum will dissipate and it will be over with. And Maria and I listened to this for a while. And afterward, I said, you know, if we followed that sort of advice, you want a cookie, you want a cookie, you want a cookie, we're going to build in habits and practices that are not going to stop with these small acts of a lack of self-control. One day, we're going to be looking at a 20-year-old saying, you just robbed a liquor store. You just robbed a liquor store. You just robbed a liquor store. And the point that I was making is a point that I believed and still believe, which is that these small testing arenas that we have when we're children about how to manage impulses and how to gain self-control and how to deal with one's temper, all of those things in those little bitty arenas teach skills that later on are going to apply in bigger arenas. I mean, that's a biblical principle that applies to all of us in our lives, not just to us when we're being parented. So I agree with everything that I was saying, but the mistake that I made was that in rejecting the absurdity of what these parenting experts were denying, which is that there needs to be a sense of authority and structure on the part of the parents, I didn't pay enough attention to what it is that they were affirming that I actually needed to hear. And the reason that this sort of stays on my mind constantly is because that child of ours who was throwing fits and temper tantrums that we just thought he needed more structure, he needed more, he needed to be rebuked more often and as soon as possible whenever he was throwing the fit in public. As the years went on, he calmed down. The fits stopped. We didn't have to do that. But I would find myself constantly sort of nagging him about how to make his way in the world. And so I would say you need to look people in the eye. You need to stop walking on your tippy toes. You need to, all of these things that what I was trying to do was to make sure that these small little areas where he was just deviating from what I considered to be normal behavior, I didn't want those to become big areas where he was going to have difficulty living in life. So I would just nag and nag and nag and constantly be on him about that. Eventually, though, later, he was diagnosed as being on the autism spectrum, really, really high functioning, but on the autism spectrum. And I started then reading about all of the neurological and sensory issues that come along with the autism spectrum. One of them, not too many years ago, that is a little book that was absolutely devastating to me. It's this book called The Reason I Jump. And it's written by a Japanese student who was diagnosed with autism when he was 5 years old. And it's called The Reason I Jump. This little book written from the perspective of this 13-year-old boy with autism was really convicting and devastating to me because he talks about what it is like to be on the spectrum and to have this sort of extreme sensitivity to certain sounds and certain textures, and how confusing it is to live in a so-called neurotypical world when one is on the spectrum. And the thing that was really important to me was the way that this 13-year-old kid was able to give analogies and to say, hey, this is what it would be like for you. What I have to deal with when it comes to trying to figure out what the mental and emotional state of the people around me is like, this is what this would be like for you in another situation. Or here's the way that sensory issues affect me. This is what it would be like for you, being in a room with horns blaring all the time. You use these analogies about this kind of extreme sensitivity to sounds and textures and things that were going on. And he said something in this book that I put it down and cried when I read it, because he said in one of the questions, because the way he writes this book is he gives questions that people might ask to those on the spectrum, and he tries to answer them. And one of them is, why do you do things you shouldn't do even when you've been told a million times not to? And he says, us people with autism hear that all the time. How many times do I have to tell you? I'm always being told about doing the same old things. And it may look as though we're being bad out of naughtiness, but honestly, we're not. We're being told off, and we feel terrible that we've done again what we've been told not to. But when the chance comes once more, we've pretty much forgotten about the last time, and we just get carried away yet again. It's as if something that isn't us is urging us on. You may be thinking, is he never going to learn? We know that we're making you sad and upset, but it's as if we don't have any say in it, and I'm afraid that's the way it is. And this was the line that did me in. But please, whatever you do, don't give up on us. We need your help. And then a little bit later, he says, true compassion is not about bruising the other person's self-respect. That's what I think, anyway. My mistake that I was making in sort of not being, I wasn't the sort of a parent who was yelling or upset or angry or those sorts of things as some people did. But I was the sort of parent who was constantly, in my way of thinking of it, on top of things and sort of coming in, here are all the life lessons that you need to know. And I would get frustrated when those life lessons just didn't seem to be taken into account. And it hit me at some point, not very long ago. Yeah, I believe in structure, and yeah, I believe in not authoritarian parenting, but authoritative parenting. And yes, the sort of permissive, let me be your friend kind of parenting that we see often does lead to terrible consequences, just as the book of Proverbs tells us that it would. But in the case of that son anyway, it became clear to me later on that throwing the fits really probably in his case wasn't about a lack of self-control. It probably wasn't about a lack of self-discipline. It probably wasn't about an ungovernable selfishness. In his case, it was probably because you have somebody who is pre-verbal, doesn't know how to express what it is that he's going through, and is in a situation in places where the sensory overload was painful and confusing and unable to understand. And he probably didn't think that there was any way that we could understand that what seemed routine to us could seem torturous to him. Maybe he didn't want a cookie. Maybe he just wanted some peace from all the scary, confusing noise in the grocery store. And that's where I think that the parenting expert on television was partly right. Now, his counsel was skewed because it fit in with a cultural moment in which almost any act of disobedience can be waved away as just a failure to communicate, a failure to understand. And it fits with a cultural moment in which often disobedience can be simply medicalized. I can't tell you how many people that I have seen who are parenting children, and the children come in and say something disrespectful to their parents, and the response that the parents give is, well, he can't tolerate sugar very well, and so he's just had too much sugar today. Or the kid burns down the treehouse in the backyard. Well, he really hasn't had his nap schedule working correctly, right? I mean, all of that stuff, it's easy to see through what's going on there. And that view of human nature is sub-Christian. And it's true that the Bible teaches us that what discipline is to teach and to teach in small things how to manage small appetites that are going to grow into big appetites and can easily become insatiable with time. Discipline is about teaching a child how actions have consequences, and giving the impression that actions don't have consequences can be horrible later on. That applies even to temper tantrums. A child who learns that a tantrum is a way to manipulate his or her parents is a child who's going to continue to have tantrums. And those tantrums are going to just change as the child grows. And so we all know people in our lives who manipulate people around them by their equivalent of temper tantrums, whether that is with some sort of rage. So you think, I don't want to tick that guy off. Or with this sort of cold withdrawal, and you think, I don't want to go through all of that drama. Well, these are people who've learned how to manipulate in that way. That's also sub-Christian. And so what I was right about was that the teaching and instruction of my children ought to be modeled after the discipline of the fatherhood of God. And what God as Father does is to teach us in these small moments the sorts of skills and habits and practices that we're going to need later on as joint heirs with Christ in the kingdom of God. That part was right. But what I was missing was this essential part of the fatherhood of God is what the psalmist says when he says that God knows our frame and he knows that we are but dust. And so there is a discipline that is indeed about teaching. It is indeed about setting up structures and boundaries. But there's a gentleness and a wisdom that comes with that in knowing who am I dealing with here. So we're not behaviorists. But we don't think that each child is just another compartment of generic human nature, and that if you feed these foods, and if you teach these lessons, and if you put into place these structures, that you're going to have this perfectly predictable outcome. No, we're dealing with persons created in the image of God, unique, different, and part of what it means to be a parent is to understand that and to understand here are some issues with one child that may seem not to be discipline problems at all, but need to be corrected. And here are some situations with another child that may seem to be discipline issues, but really aren't, or something else. And so my parenting that showed up in not understanding what was going on with my child on the autism spectrum, and again, probably didn't really manifest itself in ways that he would have even noticed. It was just mostly my internal frustration where I would say to my wife, "What? When is he going to hear me when I say you can't walk on your tippy toes? Or how many times are we going to have to tell him that you can't throw a temper tantrum in the middle of the Walmart?" That internal frustration showed me that my parenting was trying to be godly, but my parenting was missing the picture of the God who revealed himself in the cross. A God who, yes, is committed to justice and to order, but a God who also is mercifully seeking to save that which is lost. And so I thought many times that as long as I wasn't screaming or hitting, which I wasn't, and that as long as I was consistent and fair with all of my children, and I think I probably was, that I was parenting well. And I thought, though, that I was preparing my son to make it in life, and I was, but what I was missing was adequately preparing him for the life beyond this life. Because the end goal isn't just adulthood. The end goal is adulthood. That's part of it. You're teaching and raising a child toward maturity. But that maturity doesn't end at adulthood. I was missing a key aspect of who he is. And as such, I was missing the end goal, the ultimate end goal of the kingdom of God. And so I wanted him to be normal in the way that I was defining normal, so that he wouldn't have to deal with difficult situations later on in life. But in doing that, I really was focusing more on my achievement and my performance as parent and about, you know, modifying his behavior so that he would be able to make it, rather than picturing the kingdom of God. And rather than being able to say, okay, I know that you have these particular burdens that I'm going to help you to bear. I know that you're experiencing these sensitivities to certain sounds and textures, and I'm going to be there with you, and I'm going to help you through that. I was missing that part of it. I was missing the way that the Reason I Jump book talks about that constant quest to be able to figure out where one can belong when one is dealing with these particular burdens. Please do not give up on us. You know, I realized when I highlighted that passage that it wasn't just about my son, but it was about me also, because I am not on the autism spectrum, but I'm constantly sort of subconsciously pleading the same thing. Don't give up on me. I don't want my children to give up on me when I make stupid decisions or when I fail as an example. I don't want my wife to give up on me when I'm not living up to the highest ideals that I have for myself. I don't want God to give up on me, most of all, like I've given up on others in the past. And in seeing that all that is true, often I don't even know how to articulate that. All I know how to do is to cry out, Abba, Father, to groan, as Paul says in Romans 8, sometimes in utterances that are too deep for words, that cry of not just of desolation, but a cry of hope that one will be heard. In learning to do that, I need to learn better how to recognize cries like that from a little closer to the ground on earth. I need to be reminded that I'm a father, but I'm a father pointing to another father, a father who is a God of great authority and structure and a God of great patience and gentleness. And that sometimes the authority of God can be scoffed at as being any authority being oppressive. And that's wrong. But the gentleness and the patience of God can also sometimes be scoffed at as being permissive. But that's not how we've come into the kingdom. I've come into the kingdom as a child who's not here on account of my expertise or on account of my precision or on account of my brilliance, but on account of sheer unmerited gift. And often what parenting has been teaching me over the years is what I need to learn as I'm dealing with everybody around me. When I'm trying to bear patiently with people who have burdens that I don't understand, or sometimes even burdens that I don't even know about, and how to deal with myself when I'm thinking through and often judging things in the past or things in the present with this unrelenting sense of unmerciful judgment from my own heart. I need to realize that I'm trying to protect myself sometimes from burden. In so doing, I often end up protecting myself from life, protecting myself from God, and protecting myself from love. At least at the intuitive level, I think Maria and I were right about loving authority and about not being manipulated or thrown by temper tantrums. But we didn't know exactly what was going on in those tantrums, and we didn't know how to respond to them rightly. And I think that often happens in every sort of relationship that we have. It's something that I think applies to the church. Do we have a disciplined, orderly church with high expectations? Yes. And any church that doesn't have that is surrendering the lordship of Christ. But in the church, do we also learn how to bear with one another and to carry those who are falling down? Galatians 6. Yes. We teach one another. Sometimes that means correcting and rebuking one another. Often that means encouraging one another. I made that mistake in parenting. I think I've made that mistake in my Christian life, and maybe you have as well. But the good news, as always, is that God is gracious, and God is calling us all toward repentance and toward carrying the cross and better reflecting the God whose face is there in the face of Jesus Christ. This is Russell Moore, and you've been listening to Signposts.